privacy fortress. Built it up with open source gears. Graphing nails in the foam. Keeping out the spies, no tears. Linux roots deep. Servers out the basement, no leers. Self-hosted life, dodging all surveillance ears. Close the doors tight, safeguard in the night. Open source armor, no spyware in sight. Closed network privacy, our intellects might. This fortress gon' hold, ain't no surveillance bite. No big brother eyes, no corporate spies. Linux lines, encrypted ties. Self-hosted source, co-using wise. Graphene glowing, privacy rise. Freedom in the code, we template the soul. Decentralized havens, controls the goal. Building castles, data won't fold. Privacy trophies, we clutch and hold. Close the doors tight, safeguard in the night. Open source armor, no spyware in sight. Closed network privacy, our intellects might. This fortress gon' hold, ain't no surveillance bite. Algorithms balled up, scripts under our reign. Surveillance fed doubts, stayed in their lane. Kernels lit, no need for chains. Public key keys guarding the brain.
Bit of a switch up intro song. We gotta have a theme, you know? We have to have our own theme music, I feel like. What's going on, everyone? It's been a while. Simon for the Closed Network Privacy Podcast, episode number 37. Recorded today, Tuesday, August 13th. 2024. If you like that track, I will make it available. I created that. Don't cringe, but I created that using AI, using Suno. So eventually I'd like to have some music produced, but I thought it would be fun to switch it up a little bit and actually, just experiment with making our own theme music. And if this is your first time listening, I'm a fan of hip hop music. So I do tend to play that genre for intro and outro music, and doesn't mean the original is going away. It just means I'm switching things up a little bit. So yeah, I hope you enjoyed that. I had fun making it, and I actually have some different files of lyrics that I've been working on over the last probably better part of a year that I'd like to actually get produced, maybe with some online creators. If I can link up with the right people, if you know anyone, send them my way, especially if they accept Monero for payment. And I would be grateful for that. So yeah, this episode is going to be Collected All So We Can Know It All.
Who cares about the Constitution? Who cares about law? Who cares about the rights of U.S. persons? Hey, if you've done nothing wrong, I even heard this, then it shouldn't matter. And the mantra was, just get the data. Collect it all so we can know it all. Collect it all so we can know it all.
People who say they don't care about privacy because they've got nothing to hide, I haven't really thought too deeply about the issues, because what they're really saying is that I don't care about this right. When you say I don't care about the right to privacy because I have nothing to hide, that's no different than saying I don't care about freedom of speech because I have nothing to say, or freedom of the press because I have nothing to write.
That's the general theme, the general vibe. And it all comes down to the data. And I'm sure if you're like me, if you're paying attention to news in the tech world and what's changing in our technical lives, our phones, our mobile operating systems, our desktop operating systems, there is a major shift to pushing AI, artificial intelligence, and shoehorning it literally in everything that we use. It almost seems like overnight this has happened. And I'm just like, I don't know, I'm overwhelmed, and I'm sure a lot of other people who care about or pay attention to this are maybe starting to feel a little bit overwhelmed. Some of the conversations we were having today in our Matrix channel were specifically about, you know, the new Pixel phones. Is Gemini, which is Google's AI, going to be baked into possibly the hardware or the operating system, which likely it won't be baked into the operating system under the Android open source version, the AOSP, which is the baseline upstream open source version. When I say upstream, that where a lot of fixes are funneled through from different OEMs, and as well as projects like GrapheneOS and things like that, that eventually will be some of those, and a lot of them get adopted into the main branch for Google's AOSP release. So I personally don't think that Google's going to be rolling out Gemini AI where it would be available for others to view the code, meaning into the open source release of Android. I highly doubt that's going to be the case. So if you are a GrapheneOS user, for instance, for your mobile device, I think that we're probably okay. Of course, we'll all be following this through the GrapheneOS project as Apple's also rolling out their Apple Intelligence into iPhone 15s and higher with iOS 18. I have been playing with iOS 18 beta on a 14 Pro, which is too old of a device to be using the Apple Intelligence functionality or the feature set. So I think that there's a lot of neat tech that has become available to us as end users because of AI. I'd like to treat it as if it was like a when you want to use product. When I say product, I'm kind of generalizing because there's a lot of different versions of AI models out there. I personally have been running the Llama model locally on my Linux machine, and I really like it. It's running on I've got an older NVIDIA 1080 Ti in there, but it's still very sufficient to run the different models that have been open sourced and available through the Llama project. This is specifically the Llama 3 AI that you can run locally, and it's available for Windows, Linux, Mac. Anyone can download it and utilize it. You want to make sure you're using it with on a device or machine that has some pretty beefy hardware, preferably an M processor Mac, or if you're running on x86 64 architecture, you're going to be wanting to run it on an NVIDIA graphics card, as it's not really compatible with AMD graphics cards, but more, and I think it has something to do with the CUDA drivers or some of the, I don't know the specific reasons, but I do know there's some differences, obviously, between AMD and NVIDIA, where the NVIDIAs are kind of preferred for running those models, which is also why NVIDIA's market cap, I think, has nearly doubled in the last, you know, 18 months, because they're kind of winning the arms race when it comes to GPU processor, I guess, you know, superiority when it comes to running these large language models. So I think there's a time and a place. I'm not trying to resist against AI in the general sense of like the old man, get off my lawn kind of mentality. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. Of course, I would like to just take a quick moment and thank some of our Patreon supporters, those who are directly supporting the podcast. That would be Michael Bates, Richard G. Thank you for those, as well as a lot of our Lightning donation supporters, which come in through our podcast 2.0 platform, which is Lightning, being via Lightning donating Bitcoin. So thank you to all of you people, and a lot of the names are pretty common: Bond, Wartime, Circus Media, Seabass, 02ZX, our moderators on Intelligence 7 and Mattis Max, who have just been there helping out. We have some, you know, when you have large groups of people in chat rooms, sometimes things need to be fielded, and sometimes we're even the ones that are maybe causing trouble. We have to call ourselves out sometimes, but We like to keep the chat rooms very, I wouldn't say wholesome, because we are kind of all trolls, but we defend each other, we fight for each other, and we respect each other. And I think that's the biggest thing that we really focus on, is that sometimes feelings do get hurt, but at the end of the day, we want to be respecting each other as far as our differences go. But we also try to keep some of the topics that can be incendiary out. We have an off-topic channel, which is for off-topic. If you're in the Closed Network podcast main channel, that's kind of more on topic. There's some general banter in there, but it generally stays on topic within privacy, security. Hey, I'm thinking about buying this phone or this laptop, or how do you guys, what router are you guys using, or what firewall do you use? Those kinds of questions. When I say on topic, just within the topics that are not controversial. Then we have our off topic channel, which can be controversial sometimes, because some of us drop some spicy memes in there, and they don't really mean to offend. They're generally poking fun at corporate surveillance, government surveillance, big tech, that kind of thing. But, sometimes people can be take things the wrong way. And generally, we don't really ever have any issues. But because of our admins and our community members, we have a really good vibe in there, and we try to keep it that way. So if you're interested, you can head over to our website, closednetwork.io, download the Element.io app to get started, and just join the channel. You just create an account, join the channel. We do have our forums up, which I've been lacking on a little bit. I've been out of town a lot, and I've been really busy with work, but I do have some forums, topics that I'm working on. Also, the show notes are posted there as well. We do have a SimpleX chat group, and that will be in the show notes as well. If you want to try SimpleX, try it out in a group fashion. It's a great way to test it. I'm still not 100% bought in, like using it as a replacement for Signal, but it is kind of on my long-term plan for that. Social-wise, you can follow me on Mastodon. We do have our own Mastodon server, which is actually running about 40 feet from me in the basement. So that is on premises, which means the Fourth Amendment applies. There is no third-party doctrine there. It's running on premises at the house. So we have our Mastodon server. That's usually where I'm kind of hanging out social-wise, other than Noster and Twitter as well. So feel free to connect with me there or on email, simon@closednetwork.io. So that clip you heard a second ago was from Thomas Drake, NSA whistleblower. There was a video put out a few months ago, actually about 3 months ago, by Vice News, talking about exposing the NSA's mass surveillance of Americans, and topic is on cyber war. And so I thought it was kind of fitting, because the title of this is Collected All So We Can Know It All. And some of the news stories I'm going to cover kind of go into that. So I'm going to touch on COSA, which is the Kids Online Safety Act, which just did pass the House and is expected to potentially pass in the Senate, as there was very little resistance. So that likely will be signed into law after this session. And if you're not familiar with the Kids Online Safety Act, I've talked about it or spoken about it before. But we're going to talk about how the Federal Appeals Court finds geofence warrants are categorically unconstitutional. There's some continued fallout from the Snowflake hack. It's one of the biggest data breaches this year, over 1 billion records and rising, as well as some other data breaches that have been released on the breach forms, which I've been trying to download now for a few days. It's like 1.4 billion records. It's a compressed file of 44 gigabytes, but it's essentially uncompressed, a half a terabyte of data. But the server I've been downloading it from keeps airing out and closing my session. So I'm still going to continue to try to pull it down also from my desktop and see if we can get that file. If I can, I'll get it rehosted. There's been some updates to some password leaked lists. Typically, those are in the rocku.txt file, which is commonly found online. You can download in the Kali Linux distribution release for those that are into penetration testing or hacking and things like that. It's in there. If I can get to it, I'm going to try to touch on why I'm ditching Firefox, at least for now, and what I'll be switching to and what I'm kind of migrating from. There have been some updates to GrapheneOS, excuse me, as it pertains to the duress pin. Not a big thing. I mean, it is a big deal, but it's not a huge topic that I'll go on for too long. And there's been some other flaws within Windows Recall, which we know, as well as ChatGPT for the Mac app, leaving chat history exposed. And Moreover, is me just kind of talking about some of these things, which I think are important. There's been a big shift I've seen online in those wanting to move to more, I won't say more secure, but more privacy-focused operating systems such as Linux. We'll talk a little bit about that, switching from Windows to Linux. There's a really good article on the nt.io website, which coincidentally I do use, no affiliation, as well as touching on Google breaking their promise to block third-party cookies. And they have a tendency to make some big commitments and then, you know, renege on those in the final hours. And so there's a lot of, you might have heard me talk in the on previous episodes, if you're a loyal listener, about Manifest V2, Manifest V3, and what that means for third-party extensions, things like uBlock Origin and other privacy extensions that people often use to install on their browser to limit the cookie tracking and things like that. So yeah, if that sounds like of interest to you, thanks for sticking around and listening. It's been a while. I won't go into great detail so we can just get into the show, but just been busy with work. I picked up new clients. I've been traveling. I had a wedding that was out of town. I did some video stuff for, as some of you know, part of what I do for a living is media creation and development, video, photo, stuff like that. So I was doing that not as a paid thing, just as a friend helping out a friend doing some content for their special day. So yeah, I've just been I've been more active too. I've been running a lot. I've joined a run club. I've got a couple races coming up that I've signed up for as my knee is getting stronger every day. That meniscus tear is going to take quite a long time to recover, but the ACL is pretty strong. I would say I'm at like 68%, 70%. 71% back to my full strength where I was prior to Christmas when I injured my knee. So I've been busy doing stuff outside, touching grass, getting that vitamin D, and I hope you all are too, because it's important. I think that mental health, physical health, as well as our digital and privacy health are all equally important, and you should be focusing those energies just as much on your personal, abilities and skills and your health, as well as spending time and helping others with your digital journey, your privacy journey, and that path. So so we're just going to kind of get right into it. There's actually, it's kind of funny. I'm going to play this scene for you. I've been rewatching Mr. Robot like in the evenings, and there's this scene in season 2, episode 7, where if you're not familiar with Mr. Robot, it's a show kind of about hackers taking down Evil Corp, which is, if you read between the lines, is kind of like a conglomerate, kind of like Google is. So if you were to picture maybe like Google and Microsoft and maybe Apple and some other big tech companies as like one big overlord that is running people's financial lives, so they're a bank, computers, and all of that stuff. Well, they get taken down by hackers, and the system is shut, kind of broken right now. They're in a cache-only kind of mode, as all the databases have been wiped, so there's no record of who owes what on their accounts. And there's this scene where on the news they're talking about using eCoin, and I felt like maybe this is almost a premonition of like what's coming.
Trash pileups have now become a real epidemic in the city. Due to the credit crisis brought on by 5-9, many private businesses cannot afford waste management services, which has sparked a cottage industry of roadside garbage burning at discounted rates. Due to the events of 5-9, the Taxi and Limousine Commission asked that drivers now accept eCoin. Per the commission, payment can be made via mobile phone. Just download the eCoin app from the Play Store or App Store. Scan the QR code once you reach your destination, and the payment will be withdrawn from your eCoin wallet.
So I feel like in this day and age, we're getting closer and closer to this. Nothing's real. Nothing's owned. Just download the app, scan the code, and be part of the system. participate in this system. And that was one of the things why I mentioned COSA, because I kind of have some Google alerts, and I look for content, and there is this channel. I'm not calling her out, but it's called Scrolling to Death, and I'll put a link to it in the show notes. And it was actually just posted 2 weeks ago, right after the COSA bill passed. And this is kind of like your mommy blogger. I'm going to call her a normie, and it's not to be like mean towards her or ugly towards her, but this is like what I feel is the general non-educated mentality when it comes to the government trying to step in and provide solutions, selling it to you as security or private or keeping you, air quotes, safe. And this is just a 1 minute clip of her talking about promoting and glorifying this bill.
COSA has passed in the Senate 91-3. The three senators who passed on COSA are Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, Mike Lee of Utah, and Ron Wyden of Oregon. Three senators who are likely funded by big tech and are prioritizing social media's.
Take note of that. Three senators who are likely funded by big tech with no proof of that. No evidence, no links to articles of big tech contributing to like their campaigns. Why did she say that? Because big tech also thinks this is a bad idea because it puts a lot of onerous on them, a lot of the liability on them to do this. But we should also be against it.
Profits over our children's lives. This is truly a historic day and a huge win for parents who have put years behind this bill. COSA will drastically improve protections for our kids on social media. And next up, COSA moves to the House of Representatives. If we can get COSA passed in the House, it goes to the president's desk to be signed into law. And President Biden has indicated that he will sign COSA and its companion bill, COPPA 2.0, into law. The House members have left Washington, D.C. for their August recess, so we have some time now. Parents need to reach out to their members of the House and ask them to pass COSA. It is so easy to do this. Go to house.gov, enter your zip code at the top right. You have two members of the House. You can contact them both through their online forums or give them a call. A lot of times it'll ring through to voicemail, and you can simply ask your representative to vote yes on COSA. We are so close to giving our kids the protections they deserve. I promise so you will close. See a difference in how safe our kids are online.
Safe kids.
And let's make this happen.
Get all the keywords in there, right? Kids, safe online, all that kind of stuff. But in reality, what's going to happen is it's going to force people to self-verify their identity with a digital scan of their ID, which goes to what database? We don't know. We'll assume those databases will be breached, will be hacked, will be dumped on the breach forums and on the dark net and basically used against everyone who had those scans in there. And the reason why I think that this is a very slippery slope is because this is just like once something like that is instituted, it becomes the new norm. Like we've seen that through the pandemic, through COVID, where the new norm, what we all call the new norm, changed. People working from home, not traveling as much. When you do travel, you're subject to a deeper scan or more invasive scans, being forced to wear masks and all these other things, show a vaccination card, right? It's this mental conditioning to get you ready. When you went to restaurants, everything was scan a QR code, right? You couldn't actually even look at a menu. If you're a non-smartphone user, or you just leave your phone at home and go live your life occasionally, you can't even operate, right? They weren't accepting cash for payment. Sorry, I'm moving my microphone stand around. Cash wasn't being accepted at a lot of places. It was digital payment only, contactless payment only. So there was a big shift, at least in a lot of Western world civilization kind of countries where this stuff is the norm to have a smartphone and all these types of things. And since COVID, there is a lot of those that are still in place as far as that mental conditioning and just getting your brain ready for that, what's coming next. And I feel like COSA is being pitched as, hey, it's an online safety act for kids. That way kids can't sign up because they have to prove their identity. And it keeps them safe from talking to, you know, strangers and this and that and the other, which is absurd, by the way, because kids aren't using Facebook Yeah, sure, they're using Instagram and a lot of these other platforms, but there's, you know, any number of places they can go and everything, but you're talking about all the big tech platforms, so like Reddit and TikTok and all these different things. So this was a video this mom put out, and I'm not faulting her. I'm not trying to call her out, right? She, in my opinion, she's just misguided. She doesn't really understand. I want to play this TikTok video, which was actually from this girl who a year ago when COSA was first being kind of proposed, and she's kind of playing both roles in her video. So she's asking a question as one person and then answering it as a different personality. It's a 90-second clip.
Why is TikTok asking me to upload my driver's license? Oh, that new law must have gone into effect. Kids Online Safety Act. Nothing in the bill said I had to upload my ID online. I thought that was about protecting kids' privacy. No, the tech experts said COSA would always lead to this. But the senators told me that wasn't going to happen. They promised me it was about protecting kids online. You mean Senator Blumenthal, who keeps writing bills that hurt kids, on top of been wanting age verification his whole career, and Senator Blackburn? But there was a bunch of organizations in support of it, and nobody told me this was going to happen. There were also a lot of organizations opposed to it, and there were tech experts telling you to stop pushing this bill because it's harmful. That doesn't explain why half the stuff on my phone is gone, like my iMessages, all these websites that I was going on. Half the people I followed on TikTok aren't even there anymore. Yeah, the bill says attorney generals can remove anything that they deem harmful towards children. They've been using that excuse to go around censoring everything online. There's nothing there anymore. It's all gone. I don't know why you're surprised. Everybody told you this was going to happen. Also, that database you just uploaded your ID on, yeah, have fun when it leaks in a couple days. There's gotta be something I can do to stop this. Some orgs were encouraging people to post on the 26th as a sort of day of action. They also wanted people to go to bad internet bills and call their senators, as well as to call the senators on the Commerce Committee. They even gave you a script and like everything, bro. It was so easy.
So, you know, this was a year old and kind of talking about what life could look like, right, if these things were to pass. Now, this is very U.S.-centric, and I'm in the U.S., but this kind of legislation is happening around the globe, and it might be have already – some versions of this might have already passed where you live. I know there's people in the chat room, which is one thing I love about it, is we have people from all over the place, a lot of different countries, and they're kind of going through the same pain points that people are in other countries where things have been passed, been proposed to pass, or like right now here in the U.S. is kind of in the midst of passing. It's very likely that COSA and COPA will likely pass here. And if that happens, we're going to have to once again adjust to this new, air quote, new way of life, new normal, where you're going to run into roadblocks unless you participate in the system, which is going to be revealing your true identity. So being anonymous or pseudonymous online will become less and less of a normal thing. So on top of all the tracking that's already being done through all the social media platforms and the search engines, now it's going in your ISP and all of that, right? Next is going to be, you know, you're even have to do another self-verification, almost a KYC process, like getting a bank account where you have to show government-issued ID to get to use a website or a social networking, a social media platform. I can tell you right now, I won't participate in that, and I will continue using other decentralized platforms like Nostr, like Mastodon, where I can run my own instance, running SimpleX Relay, like running my own relay server over Tor. These things sound really difficult, complex, and technical. They're really not. There's a lot of tools out there, and I've covered them in the past, and I'll cover them again in the future on how you can start preparing yourself for this. Because now also, too, moving forward, you're new phones are going to have AI baked into the operating system. If you're using the stock iOS or the stock Android, whether it's Samsung, whether it's Pixel or some of these other, you know, manufacturers that are making Android phones, especially the more premium models that will have the ability to run local language models or large language models locally on device and or send it off to a cloud server to process your request and send it back. This is all going to get logged. It's all going to get categorized. It's all going to be like what they know about you now, it's going to grow exponentially. So what they know about you now is already things like your browsing habits, your travel habits, where you go, where you eat, your purchasing and transactions and those types of things, who you associate with, who you message the most. So then it's going to take it to a whole nother level because it's giving insight into your conscience. Because you're going to be, not you specifically, but you generally speaking to the general public will be using these tools thinking like, oh, this is a great feature. I can just have the AI summarize all my conversations with my friends and tell me in order of importance how I should respond to them or summarize my emails, whether it's work or personal. And then go ahead and actually recommend replies. Well, all of that's being stored. It's being indexed. And it's going to be searchable. And so, you know, the more we participate in this, the more data we're creating for them to use against us down the road, whether it be for ads or targeting us from a political or religious group standpoint. We don't really know the totality of this. Like, we're such in the infancy of AI, and it's already getting shoved in, down our throats and put in as basically software that you can't easily opt out of or remove or uninstall. We've seen this with Microsoft Windows, right? They're going to be sunsetting Windows 10, I believe, next year. So you won't be getting any security updates, which means they're going to be forcing everyone to Windows 11. We've already seen some of the debacles with Windows Recall, which is basically screenshotting your desktop and storing it locally in an unencrypted fashion, which is easily exploitable by one Python script. And, you know, if you got malware or something and it just zips all that up and sends it to a server somewhere, now they've got access to all of your bank logins and everything else. That is an opt-in feature, but it's like, little by little, big tech is going to try to get away with as much as they can. And then when you push back, they're going to step back. So they're taking like three steps forward, one step back, three steps forward, one step back. And eventually you turn around and look back and go like, how did I get here? How did I get so dependent upon these companies? They hold all my data. I don't own anything unless I keep paying a subscription fee. If I don't pay my subscription fee, I lose access to all this content, or in some cases, even content you've purchased in context of Amazon, Sony, where you've bought movies. They can retroactively just be like, I know you bought them, you know, to watch anytime you wanted, you know, in perpetuity. But we've decided to delete those from our catalog. Sorry. So now even content that you've purchased that you should be able to consume when you want it doesn't mean you own the copyright to it, but you own a right to consume as often and as many times as you want is gone. And so I'm a big proponent and have been from day one in self-hosting, even down to your media. Your music, your movies, watch it whenever you want. Run a Plex Media server, run a Jellyfin server. These things are really easy to set up with any number of server operating systems, something like Casa OS or Umbral. There's others out there that I'm not thinking of. I run a Casa OS server for my Plex and Jellyfin server, so that's just the first thing that came to mind. You know, running your own Nextcloud server, which can be a low power PC running plugged into your router or a switch that doesn't consume a lot of power, where you can locally store a backup of your phone, your contacts, own your data. That's like my biggest recommendation. On top of using like password managers and not, you know, using web app versions of social media or using containers and profiles to separate them out on your phone. I've talked a lot about compartmentalization. So I know I'm kind of bouncing all over the place because I'm super ADD and I'm currently drinking a glass of cold brew. it's probably not really helping me. But I just made some fresh cold brew, and it's really good. So I'm drinking that, so I'm a little hopped up right now. I am going to have a link in the show notes, and I will probably cover some of it, but I wanted to talk about some open source tools for productivity. On the last podcast where I had the mods on, Unintelligent 7 and Mattis Max, we covered some cool apps, and we talked about what do we all use and stuff. And so in addition to that, as a stack on to that, I'm going to talk about some free and open source tools that you can use for productivity, because I've been looking for alternatives for like Adobe products and things like that myself. So I'll get to that. But I'm going to go ahead and dive into a couple of the news pieces, just a couple quick articles. The first one is posted on the EFF yesterday. The Federal Appeals Court, U.S. centric, the Federal Appeals Court finds geofence warrants are categorically unconstitutional. So in a major decision on Friday, which would have been like the, what was Friday? The 9th or 10th. The Federal Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals held that the geofence warrants are prohibited by the Fourth Amendment. So closely following arguments the EFF made in a number of cases, the court found that the geofence warrants constitute the sort of, air quote, general exploratory rummaging that the drafters of the Fourth Amendment intended to outlaw. So the EFF applauds this decision. I applaud this decision because it is essential that every person feels like they can simply take their cell phone out into the world without fear that they might end up as a criminal suspect because of their location data was swept up in some sort of open-ended digital dragnet. And that does happen. If you're nearby a Trump rally or nearby a Kamala Harris rally or a protest or anything, you might even just be in the area passing through, your phone data, like your MZ, your subscriber ID, your serial number, mobile identifier, these things can be swept up and basically kind of thrown in saying this person was in this area or was at this rally or was at this protest. So the new Fifth Circuit case, United States versus Smith, involved an armored robbery and assault of a U.S. Postal Service worker at a post office in Mississippi in 2018. And after several months of investigation, police had no identifiable suspects. So they obtained a geofence warrant covering a large geographic area around the post office for the hour surrounding the crime. And then Google responded to the warrant with information on several devices, ultimately leading police to two defendants. So on appeal, the Fifth Circuit reached several different holdings. So the first is determined that under the Supreme Court's landmark ruling in Carpenter versus United States, individuals have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the location data implicated by geofence warrants. So as a result, the court broke from the Fourth Circuit's deeply flawed decision the prior month in the United States versus Chattery, noting that although geofence warrants can be more limited temporarily than the data sought in the Carpenter case, geofence location data is still highly invasive because it can expose sensitive information about a person's associations and allow police to, air quote, follow them into private spaces because they can follow the cell phone towers that you were pinging off of as you were moving about. And then second, the court found that even though investigators seek warrants for geofence location data, the searches are inherently unconstitutional. As the court noted, geofence warrants require a provider, almost always Google, to search, you know, the entirety of its, you know, location data, while law enforcement officials have real no idea who they're looking for or whether the search will even turn anything up. So as a result, the quintessential problem with these warrants is that they never include specific, you know, a specific user to be identified. They're just kind of like saying, hey, we're just let's just look, identify everyone in the last, in this timeline within this area, right? And so only a temporal and geographic location are given in a lot of these cases, and that's just constitutionally insufficient. Like, it's just not, it's not how you do investigations. Nevertheless, it's gratifying to see an appeals court recognize the fundamental invasions of privacy created by these warrants and uphold our constitutional tradition, you know, prohibiting general searches. So, you know, that's a big win for privacy. It's a big win for at least recognizing some small shred of constitutionality as it relates to your personal whereabouts. So if you're not the target of an investigation, you shouldn't be then included as a target of an investigation from a dragnet surveillance where that maybe there was a legitimate crime committed, but you had nothing to do with it. So it's more like pushing law enforcement to do their job and investigate, and rather than go and just seek as much data as possible and then start filtering it down. So anyways, for me, I was just like, man, that's a big win. It's a small win, but it's a big win, and we'll take it. So in a previous episode, I want to say it was 31 or 2, I talked about the Snowflake hack or leak. And so there was an article on TechCrunch that said, the title is "The Biggest Data Breaches in 2024 So Far, 1 Billion Stolen Records and Rising." And some of these records I'm actively trying to download as we're recording this episode. So this is kind of the way that these people write too is kind of hilarious. So it says, "We're over halfway through 2024, and already this year we have seen some of the biggest, most damaging data breaches in recent history. And just when you think that some of these hacks can't get any worse, they do. So from huge stores of customers' personal information getting scraped, stolen, and posted online to reams of medical data covering most people in the United States getting stolen, the worst data breaches of 2024 to date have already surpassed at least 1 billion, B as in billion, B as in boy, billion, stolen records and rising. These breaches not only affect the individuals whose data was irretrievably exposed, but also embolden the criminals who profit from their malicious cyber attacks." So it says, "Travel with us to the not-so-distant past to look at how some of the biggest security incidents of 2024 went down, their impact, and in some cases, how they could have been stopped. So AT&T's data breaches affected nearly all of its customers and many non-customers." So for AT&T, 2024 has been a pretty bad year for data security. The telecoms giant confirmed not one, but two separate data breaches just months apart. In July, AT&T said cyber criminals had stolen a cache of data containing phone numbers and call records of nearly all of its customers, which is around 110 million over a six-month period in 2022, and in some cases longer, which we don't have specifics on which are some and how much longer. So the data wasn't stolen directly from AT&T systems, but from an account it had with a data giant, aka Snowflake. So although the stolen AT&T data isn't public, and one of the report suggests that AT&T paid ransom for the hackers to delete the stolen data, which we know they probably didn't. And the data itself does not contain the contents of calls or text messages. The metadata still reveals who called who and when, and in some cases, the data can be used to infer approximate locations. But worse, the data includes phone numbers of non-customers who were called by AT&T customers during that time. And that data becoming public could be pretty dangerous for high-risk individuals, such as domestic abuse survivors, so on and so forth, journalists, and that kind of thing. So that was AT&T's second data breach of this year. Earlier in March, a data breach broker dumped online a full cache of 73 million customer records to a known cybercrime forum for anyone to see. So some 3 years after that, this is much a smaller sample was teased online. So I'm just going to touch on some of these other points. So Change Healthcare hackers stole medical data on a substantial portion of people. So this is, the U.S. Department of Justice actually sued a healthcare insurance, United Health, to block its attempt and acquisition of health tech giant Change Healthcare. So I'm going to link to this article because there's a ton of information in here about Synovus ransomware, which caused the outages across like London, as well as Ticketmaster, 560 million records there. That was stolen, and that was an outcome of the Snowflake hack as well. Some dishonorable mentions were MetaSecure, Kaiser, which is a healthcare provider in the United States, the United States Postal Service, Evolve Bank, and there's others. So I guess, you know, I've said it many times, probably ad nauseum, but just always assume that you're going to have an account somewhere with a service provider that's going to be hacked, or because of insufficient security protocols will be indirectly leaked somehow or accessed without permission. People forget about the human factor in a lot of this stuff. We think of these companies, especially tech companies, as these, you know, oftentimes they're kind of looked at as these machines that really are supposed to do everything that you expect them to do. But they're really just people in buildings. And a lot of them have good intentions and, you know, want the best for their customers and their clients from a service perspective, as well as from a data security and preservation aspect. But, you know, people make mistakes. People are infallible. And there are always actors out there that want to take advantage of a situation that they uncover, and rather than do the right thing, they're going to go the other direction, either for fame, fortune, bragging rights, or just because they're psychotic. I don't really understand. I think that there's hopefully a lot more good people, white hat hacker type of people that would expose something to be fixed rather than try to profit off of it. But it seems like the more that we rely on these third-party services to store information, from healthcare to banking to all of our utilities and mortgage lenders and all of our personal services that we use, streaming and otherwise, cloud services for all your storage, like it's like we really do give up a lot of autonomy by relying on them. And at this point, we'd have to be naive to think that, like, oh, I use Google Drive, I use Apple iCloud, surely it's secure, you know, could never be hacked, and that kind of thing, which is just, yeah, I mean, they're as secure as they can be right now. But again, there's always people that are looking to punch holes into their systems and find vulnerabilities. And there's always bad actors that sometimes work for the companies themselves. And you just have to keep that in the back of your mind. So, you know, how do you defend against that, right? Because you're like, Simon, I can't just not use my bank. I just can't not use my healthcare providers. So where this matters, and for most people, where they find they get themselves in trouble is when they use the same email account and the same password or same four or five passwords for all of their logins. So your healthcare portal, your bank, you're making your car payment online, your more, you know, all the things you log into online, whether it's paying bills or just all of your social media accounts or work accounts, you want to make sure you're compartmentalizing your different types of logins from each other by using different email addresses or email aliases. Like Simple Login is a great example. Or if you're a ProtonMail user, you can, on some of the paid tiered accounts, you can create aliases within your account. So use one email address for your financial institution. So if you have four credit cards and two banks, use one email address for those, and you don't use that email address anywhere else. And then for each account, I mean, if you really want to get crazy like me, you actually use a unique email address for every single one of those providers. And that's easy to do if you're using an email alias manager tool like Simple Login. But at a minimum, try to compartmentalize out, like, these are my financial. This email address is for my financials. This email address is one I use for my socials. This is the one I use for my actual personal stuff. So on and so forth, right? And then you're also using a password manager. And every single account you have online, I know I'm preaching to the choir because a lot of people listening do this, they do it religiously. And I'm going to just keep drilling it out there, because if you're a first-time listener or you're new to privacy and security, how to protect yourself, the best, I mean, literally one of the best things you can do if you do nothing else is use a password manager and create a unique password for every single account you use online. And then the next step would be, if you can, if they have a multi-factor authentication or a two-factor authentication, is to use, at a bare minimum, a software app like Aegis. That's A-E-I-G-I-S. It's an open source two-factor authentication tool. You can go down the rabbit hole and you can do a lot deeper stuff. But at a high level, use KeyPassXC, use Bitwarden. I don't even care if you use 1Password or even LastPass. I'd rather you use some more inferior password manager than not use one at all. So, you know, whatever works for you, whatever is the least friction for you, use that. I personally use KeyPass. I also use Bitwarden. Those are my main go-tos. For two-factor authentication, for some of the things, I just use a software authenticator tool. I use Aegis, that's AEGIS. I did use Authy, and I still have some on Authy. I haven't migrated all of them over, but I really don't care for Authy. I would, you know. And then in, you know, some of my really secure accounts, I have YubiKeys. These are physical keys that are on a keychain. They're USB Type-C and have NFC on them. On my Android device, I have an app from F-Droid called, it's actually, I think, just called YubiCo, the YubiCo app. Actually, I should just pull it up because I have my phone sitting right in front of me, right? Yeah, it's called YubiCo Authenticator, YubiCo Authenticator. So that's what I use for with my YubiKey. And I just stick it in the bottom of my phone. I can generate the one-time passcode and boom, log into your accounts. So if you don't do anything else, and if you don't listen to anything else I ever say, password manager, two-factor authentication, email aliases. If you can implement those three things and do it well, do it religiously, and don't sign up for any accounts without doing that, that's where you keep your accounts. So you come up with one crazy password that nobody else would ever know that unlocks, is basically a master, it unlocks your vault, and then in your vault you have all your logins. So why this will help you is because if you are a victim and you get the letter in the mail, right, that says, sorry, you've been, I got one of those AT&T letters. So, you know, I have one of those AT&T letters upstairs, and they'd say, like, we'll offer you free 6 months of credit monitoring, whatever. The credit vendors get hacked. They get breached. That's no help, right? The best thing you can do is freeze your credit. Freeze all your credit reports. If you're in the United States, there's three primary agencies, TransUnion, Equifax, and what's the other one? I always forget them all. TransUnion, Equifax, and something Experian. Why am I drawing a blank? Because I'm, again, ADD and Experian. Thank you. Thank you. To myself, Experian, TransUnion, and I said them all. Go there, and it's free, freezes your credit. So that way, you're also ensuring that if someone does try to use your identity to take out credit or open a bank account, it's going to be denied because your credit is frozen. So password managers, two-factor authentication, unique email aliases, compartmentalization, freeze your credit. If you do nothing else, you are light years ahead of most people who will be softer, easier targets. So that would be like level one. And that's more security than privacy focused, right? Privacy is now trying to create like pseudonyms for yourself, doing things anonymously, shielding your browsing and search and all of that stuff from companies that are just profiting off of it. And so that's where privacy kind of comes into play. But from a security standpoint, protect yourself first because these things are happening all the time. And there's a ton, right? I don't want to read all the data breaches that happen, but these are some of the big ones. And I'm trying to download one of these databases as we speak. And if I can get it, I will rehost it for our squad, for our community, for our crew. So Inti actually posted a really cool article on switching from Windows to Linux. And I've been noticing on YouTube as well as different forums, a lot of people, everyday people, not even like gamers, that are looking for alternatives for Windows because they don't like where Windows is going, because Windows is shoehorning Copilot, their Copilot AI, and all their search crap into their stuff, as well as Windows Recall, which, you know, it's basically Windows has turned into a dumpster fire rolling down shit mountain. I mean, that's really what Windows has become. I personally have never liked Windows. I've always been a Linux and a Mac user. Not always, but for a long time, long, long time, I've been using Mac and Linux. My Linux experience starts at around 2000 ish, 2000, 2001, with servers. And on the desktop, and kind of like the 2003-ish, my desktop experience was around Red Hat 5X and Red Hat 7X was when I started kind of using Linux on the desktop. But for my entire like computing adult life, I've either been using Apple and Linux together. I've always had a Windows computers, right? And I've had to work at places that use Windows. But personally, I've always used those. So I've never really been a big like Windows user other than having a gaming laptop or a gaming machine. But that's not really where I spent most of my time. So for me, I'm like, yeah, no, everyone's like, you know, not everyone, but a lot of people online are like, I want to switch to Linux because Windows is just bloated and garbage and spying on me and all this stuff. And I hate that it just does what it wants to do. And I set all these different parameters to limit the telemetry. And then every time I do a Windows update, it just resets all that stuff anyways. So they're looking for alternatives. And NT.io, which is actually a photo app manager that I use, an encrypted photo library service that you can check out. No affiliation, but I do use them. I think it's great. It's kind of a safety net backup for all my photos. It says, remember the day when you realized how much of your data was being collected by your operating system? Yeah, me too. And so they're saying like, no, I don't. It says, yeah, me too. It was like finding out your best friend had been secretly reading your diary. Not cool, Windows. Not cool at all. So recent findings from YouTube channel, the PC Security Channel, have shed light on the extent of data harvesting in Microsoft's latest operating system, Windows 11. And they say at NT, we're committed to empowering users. This is partially a sales pitch to use their service, but I thought it was a pretty good article. It says, one powerful step in this direction is transitioning from Windows to GNU Linux, GNU/Linux-based operating systems. And just the five-second tidbit, GNU in /Linux are often used by elitists because Linux is not really... Linux is a kernel, right? And then you have distributions. Distributions are things like Ubuntu and Manjaro and Arch and Endeavor OS and Gentoo and Slackware. And I could go on and on and on naming them all. There's hundreds and hundreds of distributions. But ultimately, what Linux is a kernel. And so that kernel gets adopted by different people who put a distribution together, which might have a different desktop environment or a window manager or a software package manager that, you know, they all have to kind of different variations. So because it's so open, it's very fragmented and it can be very challenging for people to find their way to Linux when they're not very technical themselves. So what they say is just understanding what GNU/Linux is, it's important to note that when we commonly call air quotes Linux, is more accurately referred to as GNU or GNU Linux. This acknowledges the GNU project's significant contribution to the operating system, including essential tools and libraries that work alongside with the Linux kernel. So why, this is their article too, by the way, this isn't me saying this. So why make the switch to GNU Linux? And they say privacy, unlike Windows, they don't collect user data by default. That's true in most cases. Security, generally less vulnerable to malware and viruses. True. Cost effective, most of them are free and open source. Also true. User friendly. Modern distributions are designed with ease of use in mind, and that's often true, especially with newer distributions, and I'll mention a couple. And performance boost often runs faster than Windows, especially on older hardware. Also true. So I'm going to link to this article because I think there's some pretty good recommendations in here. I would agree with a lot of them. The ones they recommend are Linux Mint. I think Linux Mint is a fantastic distribution of Linux for most people who are new, because you can just download it really easily, install it. It has a very Windows-esque experience where you kind of have your programs nested under a menu, which you would click in the lower left-hand side like you would the start menu on Windows. I think Linux Mint is probably one of the best to start with, honestly, for new users. And a lot of even experienced users, if you don't want a lot of fuss with your desktop, things just work. My mom has an IBM ThinkPad X1 Carbon. We were running Pop OS. I think Pop OS is a great distribution also. But she was having some problems and, you know, some small quirks here and there. I like Pop OS. It's very stable, but it's also kind of going to have older versions of kernel and packages because it is so stable. So they're also in the transition of making their own new Cosmic desktop. So they're not really rolling a lot of updates. Like they're not running the latest GNOME desktop environment and stuff. So I put her on Linux Mint. It's been working great for her. She uses it all the time. She was able to add her own printer over the network without calling me. She told me, she's like, oh, by the way, I added my printer. I was like, oh, really? It's fantastic. How'd it go? She goes, easy. I clicked add printer. It saw it on the network. It installed the driver. And then I started printing. Like, that's the way it should go. So they suggest Linux Mint, Zorin OS, Fedora, Pop OS, Elementary OS. I've actually never ran Elementary OS. I've never ran Zorin. I've heard good things about it. I do like Fedora. I actually not too long ago was running the Nobara version of Fedora, which is a gaming-centric distribution built on Fedora. I think Fedora is a great OS. I don't really run it. I'm more of an Arch guy person these days and have been for a long time, but I do like Fedora, and I actually thought about maybe running that on my main desktop. Just to switch things up. Ultimately, it doesn't really matter, but there's a lot of people that are looking to switch to Linux. Linux is a lot easier to use than it ever has before and get started. And there's a lot of free and open source applications that you can use in direct replacements for expensive ones. I know, not for all you productivity warriors out there, even like myself, video editing is a big challenge. Photo editing is getting easier. Still kind of a challenge sometimes. The applications for photo editing are getting much better. Darktable is a great one if you're a raw photo editor. I do use Lightroom professionally, but I like to use Darktable on my machine for my personal stuff. So, and before anyone reaches out to me and says, Simon, you can do video editing on Linux, just stop. I'm just a full stop right there. Yes, as an individual, you might be able to get DaVinci Resolve running. You might get it to not crash on you. You might get it to work with all the different codecs that you need specifically for MP4 importing, but it's going to be a major nightmare. And so I still do my video editing on a Mac and probably will for a long time because I need to be productive. I can't fight the system. I don't want anyone out there to think I'm an elitist and I only use Linux for everything. That is far from the truth. I use Linux for like 90% of my stuff. And then like 10%, I do use Mac OS. And that's just because it makes my life easier. And I have to collaborate with other people online using online tools. And we need to be using the same stuff. So it makes my life easier. But doesn't mean that it one day won't get there. It's just for me and that department, that's where my challenge is. But for everything else, browsing, email, doing work, it's great. As I smash my microphone, I don't know why I keep hitting that. So I apologize if that was for your headphone listeners. But give Linux a chance. You can also download these distributions and burn it to a flash drive, right? Using something like Etcher or Rufus, free apps you can just download, burn an image to the USB. Restart your computer and use the live version of the operating system. Challenge yourself. Use a live version for like an hour or two or a day. Install it on an old laptop and try it out. Force yourself to use it. You might find that most of the things you do are in a browser anyways, or there's applications that you can install just fine, like Signal and Element and Firefox and Spotify. All those things. Most of them are built are available right through the built-in software application managers. So, anyways, give it a shot. So, on the topic of this, I want to highlight some free and open source apps that you may not be familiar with. So, let me actually pop back over to my Brave browser. So, there's an article on TechCrunch once again that I came across, and I was like, "Oh, this is actually really good." There's some tools in here I didn't even know because this is more focused on productivity, not just like fun and games. So there's one design and prototyping tool called Penpot, P-E-N-P-O-T, and it's an open source web-based design tool. And it does have some paid plans, like if you want it to store your stuff or if you're an enterprise user. But yeah, you can try it out. And it's basically competing kind of with some of the Adobe like Figma tools. So if you want to do like wireframing or create illustrations and stuff like that, it's pretty cool looking. And I actually plan to try it myself. It's called PenPot for those that are into designing and prototyping. And then for scheduling, if you're the type of person that's an entrepreneur, maybe you're a therapist or dentist or whatever, and you use Calendly to have people schedule time with you, there's actually a scheduling platform called Cal.com, and it's basically an organization meeting tool, and you can go back and forth with emails and messages and phone calls, and there's an open source version of this touted as like the scheduling infrastructure for absolutely everyone is what they call. But Cal.com can also be self-hosted, which is pretty baller, actually. Like that, I love when there are providers of solutions that allow their software to be self-hosted. Like for instance, Bitwarden, you can use their free version, but they also have a hosted one. So your password manager would connect to your password database, which is stored in their cloud server in the vault, and you can pay a subscription like $30-$40 a year. Or you can install Vault Warden on a server at home and self-host that exact same experience. And you might ask yourself, well, why would I want to use a remote host? Well, because if your database is stored locally on your phone and you don't have a backup of it, and you drop your phone in the lake or the pond or the toilet or whatever, the pool, or it gets ran over by a dump truck. I don't know why that would happen, but that would be kind of funny if it did. If it got ran over by a dump truck, I was thinking something that had big tires on it, big wheels, it'd probably crush your phone. And now your passwords are now destroyed. Well, now you're kind of like, dang it, I should have backed that up. And now so that's why, right? That's why you might want to use your own cloud, your own server running in your own house or business or friend's house or mom and dad's or sister or brother that you control. It's in your domain. And it doesn't fall under third-party doctrine if you're in the United States, because it's not third-party, it's one party, your party, and I'm here to party with you. So check it out, cal.com. You can self-host it. For those that like to do screen recordings, OBS is a great tool, but also a lot of people use a tool called Loom, L-O-O-M. So if you've ever wanted to like screen record something so you could send it to somebody, and you know, you can do a voiceover and all that stuff and show them the different things. Maybe you're collaborating on like a art project or a website together. You might do a screen recording and you know, you're talking like, hey, I think we should move this here and do this and that and the other. Well, there's a screen recording tool called Screenity, S-C-R-E-E-N-I-T-Y. By the way, the links will be in the show notes. They'll be on the forum. So don't have to memorize this stuff if you don't want to. But if you're listening to this and you just want to, you know, search it up while I'm talking, that's what it's called. And it does the same thing. So, you know, you can, it's an open source Loom alternative that doesn't sit under the, you know, big corporate veil, so to speak. And it does require a Chrome browser to use, like a Chromium-based browser. So it is limited to that. So that's the only downside. For those that are into video conferencing, like we'll just use FaceTime as an example. I am a big fan of Jitsi. Jitsi is a video conferencing tool. It's free and it's open source, and you can deploy it in your own environment if you wanted to. So anyways, Jitsi, meet.jitsi.com is their website. You can fire up like instead of a Zoom alternative, right? Like if you hate Zoom, I hate Zoom. You want something that's more privacy respecting and even anonymous, Jitsi is a great one. Nextcloud is a great storage solution. It's a little bloaty and a little kind of resource intensive, just a little bit. But for what you get out of it, I think it's pretty good. I've been running Nextcloud for a few years and love it. Couldn't live without it. Probably will stay with it for quite some time. You can actually pay Nextcloud to host for you, or you can host your own Nextcloud server again in your grandma's basement and connect to it and get your friends and family members to use it. really awesome. So it's kind of like Dropbox and your contacts and all that in one web app. And I love it personally. So anyways, they have some other ones like Ghost Publishing, which is a content management system similar to like WordPress that you can host. I've used Ghost in the past. I'm a big fan of it. I think there's a lot of cool features. I'm still like a WordPress person. So I typically gravitate to WordPress because I know it so well, but Ghost is pretty fast and I like it a lot. I think it's cool. And I may at some point switch over the closednetwork.io website from WordPress over to something like Ghost. May or may not self-host. I don't know. We'll see. I'm already self-hosting a lot. Why not throw some more in there, right? You know, we got the forum, we got the Mastodon server, we got the web server. Like, well, you know, let's do Matrix. Let's do it all. I say so. We'll get to that. For those that are coding developers, there's Tabby, TABBYML, which is like a coding copilot. So it's kind of got some like AI stuff built into it to help you with some of your coding assistance. But you know, it's an open source and it can be self-hosted. And something they hope to address is like, I guess some seed funding to raise money. But it calls an open source GitHub Copilot alternative, one that can be entirely self-hosted. Why I've liked this article is because a lot of these tools, other than a few, can all be self-hosted. I love that. I want to host all the things all the time until it breaks. And then you're like, ah, crap. And you're 2,000 miles from home and your server just decided to, you know, take a nap and you're like, dang it. Sucks. And those moments I'm like, why do I self-host? Why do I do this to myself? But because it's awesome and it's painful, and sometimes pain is good. This is why people work out. This is why people push themselves to go running. Not because it's fun, but because if there's some pain, that means there's a reward. And sometimes I look at self-hosting in the same way as like, do I really want to self-host this? It's going to be painful. And I'm like, yes, because the payoff is rewarding and it's worth it. But things are getting much easier to do these days than ever before. Chatwoot, for those who may have a business, is a very cool open source self-hosted customer engagement platform where people can open tickets and have chat and all that kind of fun stuff. Chatwoot, C-H-A-T-W-O-O-T. PhotoPrism. I know a lot of you already listening use PhotoPrism. We've talked about it in the Matrix chat. It can be self-hosted. It's basically like a very cool photo gallery library organizational management tool. It's an alternative to something like Google Photos, and it'll read metadata, and you can look at things like people and locations and stuff. You can favorite stuff. It has some really cool features built into it. And PhotoPrism is awesome. So PhotoPrism is another one. Bitwarden, they mentioned, and I already just mentioned that you can self-host that with Vault Warden. There's a task management application called App Flowy. We actually talked about this before on the podcast. I think on Intelligence 7 or Mattis Max, we were talking about App Flowy. Pretty cool. It's basically a self-hostable solution with basically taking, like, managing projects and taking notes, creating documents, tracking the status of individual products and deadlines. So this may be something that you want to use personally or something that you use in collaboration with coworkers and things like that. There's a very cool link management tool that I actually didn't even know about until I came across this article called dub.co, dub.co, link management. So what is link management? So for link shortening and management, there's a company, Spectrum Equity owned Bitly, right? One of the popular tools or popular online URL shortening services. So if you have a long URL and you want to shorten it to post on a social media platform or something like that, but also track like how many clicks it got and stuff like that, you can actually use dub.co link management. So if you know what link management is, then this might be, especially if you run like a small business or something and you want to have ways to have like a branded link so you can personalize your link. Like, let's say it's like shortened. Like, you know how Google has like what, g.co/blah, blah, blah. You can do that for your own organization. I think it's cool. It's a little nerdy, but anyways, I'll have that. You can go check it out in the show notes. And I'm going to go right back into passwords, 10 billion passwords leaked in the largest compilation of all time. So this is where I was talking about the rockyou.txt file. The king is dead. Long live the king, right? Cyber News researchers discovered what appears to be the largest password. I'm using like my Trump, like huge, the biggest password compilation with staggering 9.9 billion plus unique plain text passwords. So the file data titled RockYou2024.txt was posted on the 4th of July by forum user known as Obamacare, which is absolutely hysterical. I don't know why I think that's funny, but I think it's funny. Obamacare user posting the largest RockYou.txt file. So while the user registered in late May 2024, they previously shared an employee database from a law firm from Simmons & Simmons, a lead from an online casino, Ask Gamblers, and student applications for Rowan College at Burlington County, wherever that is. The team cross-referenced the passwords included in the RockYou 2024 leak with data from Cyber News leaked password checker, which revealed that these passwords came from a mix of old and new data breaches. Okay, you might be asking yourself, like, Simon, why the hell are you telling me this? Like, what does this even mean? So credential stuffing attacks are pretty damaging for users and businesses. So basically what they do is they collect, hackers will collect these passwords and put them in one big conglomerate database. So for instance, let's say they want to hack into something. They can use this known password file to run against even things like cracking Wi-Fi passwords or something like that, because these passwords have been known to be used. So they can be used in like brute force attacks. I've used RockYou.txt files in the past when running things like Airmon, like which is a error cracking or a Wi-Fi cracking tool. Basically, if you're in penetration testing or in hacking, you probably are very familiar with what a RockYou.txt file is. So this is all to say is that particular file is getting bigger and bigger and bigger because of all these data leaks and all these credentials are being compiled. So threat actors could exploit this particular file password compilation to conduct brute force attacks and gain unauthorized access to different kinds of online accounts by individuals, you know, who are found to be in these data sets. So anyways, if you're into that hacker game, I think it's going to be included. If not already, it'll be on GitHub for the Kali Linux distribution, because I know Kali comes with, I don't know, does it still come with the RockYou.txt file? I haven't actually ran Kali in a little while. It's been a 5 or 6 years since I was probably playing with it last time, but I think I might have had to download it. I don't think they would have included. Maybe they did. I don't know. Maybe for ethical reasons they don't include it. But anyways, this was on the breach forums, and yeah, it's pretty easy to get. It's going to be all over the web. So if you're into that lifestyle of hacking stuff, go for it. We're at an hour and 15 minutes. I wanted to talk about, so we talked about the fallout from the Snowflake hack. Probably just linked to the third-party cookie stuff, because by this point it's kind of old news. And if you're paying attention, you probably already noted that Google kind of backed out on blocking third-party cookies. They were going to go to this whole other cohort system. We talked about FOSS and switching to Linux and different open source tools. I guess one thing I do want to mention is GrapheneOS did release a very cool feature not too long ago called the duress pin. And what that is, everyone is familiar with, you know, putting a passcode on your phone, right? You set up your phone, you set up a security unlock code to get back into your phone. You might use biometrics like face scan or thumbprint or something like that, but at a minimum, you're going to be required to put in a PIN number, which unlocks your phone. So what this duress password that GrapheneOS rolled out is basically a password that you could put into your phone to, air quote, unlock it, but it will irreversibly wipe the device along with any eSIMs on the device and any like credentials or anything. Basically, it just goes to a lock screen. You're nuking it. So basically, it says the wipe does not require a reboot and cannot be interrupted. How gangster is that? So if you're traveling internationally and you get stopped and like, we want you to unlock your phone, or you get stopped by the authorities and they're, you know, harassing you. They want you to unlock your phone. You can be like, yeah, no problem. And they might even be holding the phone and they say, well, give us your unlock pin. You can give them this duress pin, okay? So it's an alternate pin. They put it in thinking they're going to unlock the phone and it will wipe the phone. It doesn't need to reboot and it can't be stopped once it's started. What? I mean, how based is that? That is some gangster shite right there. I love that. It makes me so happy that I'm like a Graphene OS user. It makes me feel like I'm in a secret club or something and like I'm a gangster and like I do hood rat stuff with my friends and now I can like protect myself by having this duress pin. If you have Graphene OS on your phone, you just go to settings, security, and then duress password under the owner profile. So you can't be in one of your other profiles. You have to be in the owner profile of the device. And then you can set a duress pin and a password for the account. And you can, you know, set it to different profiles that may have different unlock methods. So, you know, that way you can use it. But you want to go there, settings, security, duress password, and the owner profile. So anyways, I thought that was pretty gangster. If you didn't know about that, now you know, and you should go enable it and turn it on because it's awesome. And you never know, you might find yourself in a situation that, you know, you didn't anticipate where that might come in really handy. I mean, what's the worst case? You never need to use it, right? Awesome. Then, you know, then you're good. But if you do need to use it, you're probably going to be like, yo, yeah, I'm going to be all right. I can't incriminate myself with my phone. Okay, so I wanted to touch on one last thing before I depart, and that's on Firefox, because Firefox, damn it, Firefox, like, why you got to be like this? You know, I've been a fan of Firefox for a very long time. It's always been a good alternative to some of the other browsers. You know, some of the Chromium browsers I do use, and I like them. I like Brave. I think it's okay. It's not the best. I've been using LibreWolf, and on my Mac, when I want more privacy-focused browser surfing, I use the Mulvad browser, which is made by the people that make the Mulvad VPN. I think it's available on all platforms because I'm running it on Linux too. Yeah, let me look at my laptop. I've got it installed over here. Let me check. Now I'm like second-guessing myself. Yeah, I've got Mulvad browser right here. So it's on Linux, Mac, and Windows, I think. All of them? Yeah, pretty sure. Not on mobile, though. That's what it is. No mobile browser, but so Mulvad, if you listen to this podcast, please, at least for Android, just give us an APK file. I would love that. It would be so awesome. So yeah, I'm using LibreWolf, but let me just touch on why, right? Because they bought an advertising company, right? Mozilla has acquired, this is an article from last month. This is actually right on their own blog, blog.mozilla.org. I'll have a link to this blog post, but Mozilla has acquired Anon.m, a trailblazer in privacy preserving digital advertising. This strategic acquisition enables Mozilla to help raise the bar for advertising by ensuring user privacy while delivering effective advertising solutions. I'm going to call bullshit. The online advertising industry is undergoing a significant transformation. With growing consumer concerns and increasing scrutiny from regulators, it's evident that current data practices are excessive and unsustainable. Yeah, okay. We're at the forefront. I mean, who wrote this? We're at the forefront of a pivotal shift in how privacy and advertising coexist, reshaping the digital landscape for advertisers, platforms, and consumers. This was totally written by a PR person, by the way. Amidst the moment of change, Anon.m stands out for its unique privacy-preserving technology by securely combining encrypted data sets from platforms and advertisers. Anon.m enables scalable, privacy-safe measurement and optimization of advertiser campaigns, thereby leading a shift toward a more sustainable advertising ecosystem. Okay, here's how it works. Secure environment data sets are matched in highly secure environment. What is even that? Ensuring advertisers, publishers, and Anon.m don't access any user-level data. I'm doing all sorts of air quotes. Okay, you can't see it, but it's happening. Anonymized analytics. Whatever that is, so the process results in anonymized insights and models helping advertisers measure and improve campaign performance while safeguarding consumer privacy. Differential privacy algorithms. These algorithms add, air quote, noise to the data, protecting it from being traced back to the individual users. I'm going to call total BS on this, right? Because you can't be the browser company and the advertising agency and expect me to think that there's not a way to de-anonymize the data you're collecting. Like, it just, it doesn't work that way, right? I mean, I just don't believe you. I don't believe you, Mozilla. I've lost faith, and there's going to be more telemetry collected in order for their ad platform to be effective, right? So in their trusted execution environment, they have a private audiences. They have private ML, which is their machine learning, right? So now we're also putting AI into the mix. And then they have their private measurement. So the way they break these three tiers out are private audiences are in non-IMS, innovative audience creation solutions. So what a bunch of garbly gook. Creation solutions use private propensity modeling, enabling businesses to broaden their reach and enhance performance, all while safeguarding user privacy. Okay, then they have their private machine learning. So AnonM collaborates with top advertising platforms, which are not named here. Who are these top advertising platforms? It says they collaborate with them, okay, to enhance ad decision making through advanced machine learning, which this is all just marketing fluff, while ensuring data privacy, optimizing performance, and increasing yield, okay? And then for the advertiser data, they have what's called private measurement, which is a non-IMS privacy-safe measurement approach, provides advertisers with valuable insights for decision-making without the need to share user-level data. I just don't believe it. I don't believe it. Like, I'm not buying it. Their website is, literally, it looks like they threw up their website in like 2 days with a bunch of boilerplate crap. And, the homepage, the game has changed in today's landscape. Driving and advertising performance requires privacy enhancing approaches to data driven marketing. And AnonM's privacy preserving solutions allow you to take full advantage of your data assets. What a load of crap, man. Like, this is. And they probably use ChatGPT to write that, honestly, the way it sounds. Like, it's just like you're saying a bunch of nothing. It's like listening to, no offense, but it's like listening to Kamala Harris speak. I know she's a smart individual, but she has zero stage presence. She cannot convey thought. She can't communicate eloquently. There's no beginning, middle, and end. Probably like this podcast, which I apologize for. But what I'm saying is like, you're saying things without saying anything at all. And that's the way I'm reading this. And AnonM website and all their marketing crap is like, they're very mysterious about it. They don't actually define who these partners are, number one, that they're sharing. They literally say AnonM collaborates with top advertising platforms. Who? What top advertising platforms? Google? Bing? Facebook? So, yeah, already, no, I'm not buying that. So this is on their blog. Like, this is their thing that they posted. Laura Chambers last month. This acquisition marks a significant step in addressing the urgent need for privacy-preserving advertising solutions by combining. And by the way, if you don't know much about like some of the shadiness that's gone on with Mozilla over the last year or so, Brian Lunduke has some great articles that I'll have. He has on his blog, and he has some videos and his editorial. He's kind of editorializing his thoughts about it. But Mozilla sued for discrimination by their former CEO, right? And then this guy goes on giving himself like crazy. I was trying to find. So Mozilla, the mega corporation, had some peculiar finances for quite some time, including skyrocketing CEO pay while Firefox market share nosedived. Mozilla repeatedly stated that artificial intelligence is a core part of their business going forward, which, okay, we'll see where that goes. They're going to need money to build that out and run it. So why not buy an advertising campaign and sell out all the people that use your browser? Some members of Mozilla board conducted what appears to be a hostile takeover of the corporation, resulting in a lawsuit from the person originally slated to become the new CEO. Okay. The hostile takeover was followed almost immediately by the purchase of this advertising company while I was just reading the website, AnonM. And now, quickly, Mozilla has implemented their advertising-specific functionality into the latest Firefox release, meaning it's already there. If you're using Firefox, this information is already being collected. It may not be actively targeting anything towards you, but it's surely going to be collected. Here's the thing. If something is tracking you, it's tracking your browsing habits. It's categorizing what your interests are. It's going to try to formulate some demographic information, your age, your race, your religious or political affiliations. It's going to already be geo-aware based on your IP information, so it's going to know what's relevant and what's not. And before you know it, you're going to start seeing ads that are 100% targeted towards you for, you know, getting and wrecking the browser experience and the internet experience overall. Just destroying everything that was beautiful about the internet. Everything has just come into full circle where back in the early days of the internet, when you were using bulletin board systems and dialed in the things into, you know, directly, slowly moved over to the ISP experience by Earthlink and Mindspring and CompuServe and Prodigy. And you kind of were joining their world, and then you could open a browser and go up to the internet, right? It was like you did shopping on there and you could buy plane tickets. I never did. I was too young, but I remember it. And then we kind of ditched this whole like walled off, closed gate environments like CompuServe and Prodigy. Remember getting those? If you're old enough to remember getting the free like 30 hours on a CD, and you would just burn through them and create new accounts all the time just so you could get on the real internet. Eventually, then we just started having an ISP, which gave you an IP address, and you just do whatever you want on the internet. There was no portal, right? And now I feel like we're going right back to this like portal, air quote, portal world, where they want to keep you inside these certain portals, whether it's Apple's portal, Facebook's portal, Meta, Instagram, whatever, you know, Amazon and Google, right? It's like, we don't want you to leave our portal environments. We want you to stay in here. So that they can monetize your traffic, monetize your attention. And to me, I see Mozilla going down the same path. The once beloved, you know, browser that I've always kind of been my go-to is now becoming like, man, I hate you. I don't want to use you. And I even want to talk negatively about you. I'm going to talk about your mom, right? So that's how I feel about Firefox right now. So I'm using Chromium. I'm using Brave. I'm using the Mulvad browser. I'm using LibreWolf. I don't use one browser. I do different things in different browsers depending upon what I'm doing and what accounts I'm logged into and that kind of thing. And then, of course, you know, Tor is what I use quite a bit as well, the Tor browser. But mostly I use that in a Unix environment. A lot of these things that I talk about, I'm going to actually make a point because I think I want to break these out into individual digestible like little blobs and put them on the Patreon because I have not done a very good job at posting content there and I feel really crappy about it. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to talk about how I use some of these things and rather it doing a big podcast episode on those. I'll probably incorporate it into the podcast, but I think I'm going to spend time doing it over on the Patreon. By the way, you can sign up for Patreon under a free account and you can still see the content. It's just that that's where I can add additional value to the people that want to support financially for the podcast. So that's why I'll put it there because it's just easy to put somewhere. So it might be a screen share, it might be a podcast, it might be something else, but I will deep dive into these because I think they're important to expand on and talk about what is Hunix. You know, well, I'll do a video on that. I'll do a screen share. You can download VirtualBox. You can download the Hunix OVA file and import it. You have a gateway in a workstation. I'll show you how to use it. So if you want to search the dark web, the dark net safely using Tor, that's one way to do it. Tails is another great way to do it. You can just download the Tor browser to your desktop. I don't personally like that. It makes me feel kind of like icky for whatever reason. It's probably perfectly fine to just download the Tor browser and use it. I also use Orbot on my Android device, so I can specify certain applications I want to route through Tor. So for instance, sometimes I use Google Maps because I'm traveling by car and I need those directions and I want to know where the popo's at. So I tunnel all my Google Maps data transfer through Orbot. You'd think it's slow, but it's not. Actually, it works great. I don't know. I mean, I know, sure, there's other telemetry that might be collected, but the more stuff I can anonymize, the better, right? So Holy cow. That's a lot to spew out. It's probably there's more stuff I didn't get to, but I'm just going to leave it in the show notes. Come by, check it out. You can click on the link in the podcast app, wherever you're at. You should be able to click it and go to the forum to see all of the content there. And gosh, yeah, I think I think that's going to wrap it up. I'm going to go ahead and just chop it now because I've been talking too much. I'm kind of hungry. I'm a little hangry. And I really have missed you all. I'm sorry for the 1 month or 5 week delay or whatever it's been. I'm going to try not to do that very often. Sometimes I have to, but I'm going to try not to do that. And until next time, I will see you in the chats. I'll see you in the interwebs. And I'll catch you on the flip side. All right, take care. Oh, yeah, whoa, look, they can never keep me down, I'm going, and if I ever fail, just know I'll go again. I never quit, because I know that every loss may lead to another win. I'm going up. I bet when I land, they gonna tell me it's luck again. See that I'm winning, it's harder to watch. I'm setting the stage, you should give me my prize. You ain't got a soul, you lacking the spirit. You talk out your neck, I'm gonna show you I'm with it. I've been really happy for you to sit and watch me win again and win again and win again. I know